You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont poet Pamela Heinrich McPherson. When I spoke with Pamela last week, we discussed her 2016 collection, Vigil, The Poetry of Presence, which concerns her work with the dying through a program called No One Dies Alone. A passionate advocate for quality care at the end of life, Pamela Heinrich McPherson has served for over three decades in various roles, including that of a volunteer as well as a hospice team member. The privilege of being present to the dying through sitting vigil is where she finds life's deepest meaning. When I spoke with Pamela, I asked her to begin by reading the poem Soul Gifts, which is at the beginning of her collection.
Soul gifts, the gift of time, of silence, the practice of presence, listening, giving dignity, respect, and compassion to each dying person as I sit alone sharing sacred passing moments. Gentle touch, soft reassurance, my small gifts to give as I bear witness as I am being with. Gifts from the soul, time, and presence.
Mm. Thank you very much for reading that. So that's the opening poem of the collection, and I thought that was a really good starting place.
Sure.
Maybe we can just talk a little bit about how you first came to sit and be a support person for people who are dying and alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've actually been involved with end-of-life care for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I became a hospice volunteer in 1985.
Oh, wow.
So even though the seed was planted before that, that's when I acted upon it. And in 2004, I retired having been a volunteer coordinator for the hospice program for 16 years.
Okay.
And at that time, I was thinking about what I would like to do with my newfound time. And there is a program at the hospital called No One Dies Alone. The acronym is NODA.
Okay.
And so I inquired about that program because I felt I was already trained for doing what they were seeking volunteers for, and thought that that might be something I'd be interested in being involved in. So I took a brief training. And this is actually a national program that not all, but many hospitals have that started out on the West Coast.
Okay.
Created by a nurse who was asked to sit by a patient, an elderly man, to sit with him. And she had to give meds and do a couple of things and said she would be right back. And when she came back, he had died.
Oh.
And he had asked her to sit with him.
Oh.
And she felt so badly about that. That's how the program was created.
Yeah.
So it's a program for sitting with people in the last, could be days, could be hours, and could be moments of
right.
their life as volunteers.
And keeping them company while they go.
Being present.
Being present.
Simply being present.
Yeah.
Because there's often not an exchange between you and them other than being intimately close to them physically.
Yeah. The No One Dies Alone program at UVM, how does one get involved in that?
Well, it's at the University of Vermont Medical Center, and it's run by the volunteer program there.
Okay.
And so one can simply make an inquiry.
And is there a training program or some sort of?
It's a very brief training.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Do a lot of people participate?
Well, I think that there's a healthy list of people who have been prepared to do this. However, it's the requests come on almost a moment's notice.
Yeah.
So it comes out by email, simply says we have a patient, and you call in if you're available to go in and sit for a few hours. So while there are a number of people on the list, the ability to cover needs that arise varies greatly on
sure,
the timing.
Sure. I wonder if you could read the poem Still Point.
I would love to. That is one of my favorites. I feel like this poem, for me, really says what this is about for me. The first poem talked a little bit about the generalities of being present. This one is much more specific. Still point. Me, a stranger at your bedside, your hand held in mine as, in this stilled, dimly lit space that is your hospital room, I breathe with you, matching my breath to your shallow, fading air exchange. How could I know what I was about to receive? Your presence, your dying, brings me to my still point, the place of centering and calm so difficult to access in the hum and buzz of everyday living, a place where nothing exists beyond our shared sacred presence. To not die alone, to bear witness to this sacred transition, to stand in for all whoever loved you, a privilege beyond description. Spirit, be free. Fly in the space of complete peace and be held in the all-accompanying embrace of all loving ancestors.
Thank you for reading that one, Pam. That's beautiful. I noticed as I read these poems that a number of them include references to holding hands, which does seem like something that you'd be able to offer to somebody. You know, it seems like it would be hard to know what to do for people or have very many things at your disposal to help them through. But holding hands seems like a real ever-present theme through these poems. Do you find that that's something that people want?
Most of the time, the majority of the time that I'm sitting with someone, they are not responsive, either in the last stages of living, and in a state of sleepfulness, mm-hmm. or are receiving medication to help them be in a better place of peace in this process. And so I really have to trust my gut.
Yeah.
You know, when I arrive at an assignment, I always stop before I go in the door and center myself. For me personally, it's really important just to take that little pause and leave everything about me and what's going on in my life outside the door.
Yeah.
To enter in a state of openness and open heart, to see, to experience fully what I will find when I go through the passageway into the room. And then beyond that, I just have to trust my gut and my intuition.
Mm-hmm.
I always sit close.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I always speak to someone when I'm close to them and tell them who I am and that I'm going to be sitting with them. Touch is just another means of letting someone who isn't awake mm-hmm. or as aware know that someone is near them.
Yeah.
So it's about finding ways to be a gentle presence mm-hmm. without imposing my values or shoulds.
Sure. And so that's a question I have. Does the nursing staff often have some information that they can give you to help you know, for example, is this person a religious person? Would they like you to read passages from the Bible or anything like that?
That's a great question. You know, having been involved with the hospice program for years and placing volunteers and working hard to guarantee their success in their assignments, we always gave lots of information about the patient and family. It's confidential, of course, that is respected, but so that volunteers can be well prepared for what they will, the experience they'll be having. It's different at the hospital. I receive very little information.
Mm-hmm.
I know the person's name and room number. I almost never hear anything about spirituality.
Okay.
We do hear if the reasons for our being there, if there's family and they're exhausted and they're going home to sleep, or the family's out of town and coming in and we're there until they come.
Mm-hmm.
And we might hear a diagnosis or, and maybe how long the person has been in the hospital, but really, truly, that's a pretty broad brushstroke of what we might get.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I remember when my mother was dying, she was very affected physically at the end. She had sort of had strokes and whatever.
But my sister brought in posters to put up all over the room of the hospital room, pictures of her when she was, you know, much more herself and looked like herself and was more of a vibrant personality, and just to remind the nursing staff who this person was. Do you find that sometimes people are in such a hurry that they have a hard time sort of seeing each of these patients as individuals? There is a little bit of a theme in the book about care and the consistent quality of care. But go ahead.
So the question is, do I find that? And I think pretty much the answer is no.
Okay, good.
My experiences at the hospital, for the most part, have been with extremely caring staff.
Yeah.
They seem to know the individual that we're going to sit with in through ways of caring for them and getting to know their family. And I've been very impressed with how caring they are. There are exceptions to every rule, as we know.
Sure.
And I certainly have had a few times where I've witnessed nurses that either seemed younger and less rich in life experiences, and or I'm a nurse who is just so busy in that particular time that I'm there. They're always so grateful and always express it to us for sitting with patients for them.
Yeah.
But they're really the exception.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and I wanted to ask you about your process of writing these poems. How did you come to be writing poems? You've brought with you your journal, your hospice journal. Or is it your hospital? Is this for NODA?
It's really for the end-of-life care experiences I have, yes.
So how did you come to write the poetry? And I'm curious about the process. Do you sort of think about things and then go home and write poems? Or are you sitting with a journal at the bedside sometimes? How does that work for you?
I always carry my journal with me because that's where I put my assignment.
Okay.
My basic information.
Yeah.
And so I always bring it with me. It's in my purse. I usually bring something to read that's not like a novel, but in a meditative mode, in case, because often I really love the 9 to midnight block of time.
Okay.
And if I get tired during that time, I have something I can pick up and read, but something that's a little pensive and still keeps me very present.
Sure.
In the situation I'm in. So my journal will be there, and it's very interesting because as I sit there in the silence and the quiet, it's massively quiet. It's beautifully, sacredly quiet most of the time when I'm there. Something will come to me, a question. I mean, there's certainly a great mystery around the whole experience of witnessing someone dying and the process. And something will come to me, and it will be a phrase or a wondering. And I'll open my journal and write it down, and my pen just seems to keep writing. It seems to keep moving.
Yeah.
And when I get to the end, I'm done.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what most of the poems are in my book.
Yeah.
They're very spontaneous. They're my processing of a moment that my mind is wondering about.
Okay. All right.
Or reacting to.
Yeah.
Or my heart is reacting to.
I wonder if you could read the poem called Socks Rock.
Sure. You know, all of my poems, almost all of them, still have a face for me. I remember the situation I was in, and this is no exception. This was a woman who was in her fifth decade and had minimal family and had appeared to have had some hard life circumstances, I would say. And when I sat with her, she was cold. She just kept saying how cold she was. So the poem will tell that story. Okay. I'll just jump right into it.
Okay, great.
Socks rock. I'm freezing, she mutters, and her hands are indeed. Every 30 to 45 seconds, arms reach out, flail. I'm freezing, she repeats. We hold hands, warming under the covers, touching, rubbing, all to no relief, though feeling warmer to me. The pattern continues. Finally, at 10 o'clock, I get the idea. Hospital socks. I know what we can do. One moment, dear. I am thinking I'll get some pretty blue ones. Soon her hands are encased. Voila! Soft middies. She slowly settles into sleep. I feel fatigue creeping in. The hour is late. Our third born arrives on a late night flight tonight. I'll go meet him when I leave. Good night, dear and fragile one. Stay warm in peaceful sleep. May angels soon come and warmly bring you home.
Mm. Thank you. I wanted to ask about that one because it does seem like an example of a time when you were able to offer some very specific aid. And I would think that would be satisfying to you to be able to kind of, I mean, these people are dying and there's nothing that can be done for them. And obviously most of this is waiting. So being present and keeping them company and sitting with them is a wonderful thing to be able to do. But to be able to give her warmth, that just seemed like something else, you know, something on top.
It was satisfying and it was creative problem solving, I would call it.
Yeah.
I felt really good about getting, it reminded me of when you put the little middies on kids with the string that goes up and around and over their neck and the middy comes out the other arm.
Right. And I also liked how that poem ends because it reminds us that indeed you have a life that you're still living, you know, and you're going to go to the airport and meet somebody and life is going to keep going. And I mean, that's very poignant, the, you know, the difference between the one person in the room and the other and what's happening.
The juxtaposition.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask you, Pam, there's a quote in the book. You have these lovely epigraphs at the beginning of each section. You have a number of different sections of your poems. And one of the quotes is by Emerson. It is one of the most beautiful compensations of life. No man can sincerely try to help another without helping himself. And I thought that was so apt because you must get so much out of this experience. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how it's affected you in your own life doing this?
You know, I've been involved in end-of-life care for over 30 years in many and varied ways. But for me, I'm 74 at this point in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm retired. My life has been full and has been good. And I've witnessed dying of family members, and thought about dying myself. You know, at this point in my life, it's something that comes closer. And what I have found in the past, I've been doing this for about 12 years now, is that it's just such a hugely sacred, magical time full of mystery. It's a time that, for me personally, that I just quiet. Mm-hmm. That's what my poem Still Point is about. It's a guaranteed time of silence and reflection and deepening appreciation for my life. Mm-hmm. as I bear witness to what is inevitable for all of us. It's a privilege. And on the practical side, because of the way the program runs, it's very flexible for me to be involved. An email comes, and if I'm free that evening or whatever, I can jump on it and be one of the people that responds quickly and gets in there. That flexibility fits really well with my life now.
Sure.
So it's a combination of something very practical as well as something that brings deep meaning.
Yeah. How often are you doing this?
Usually we do this in blocks of 3 or 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And occasionally we get back in a second time if someone lives a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But it's usually a few times a month.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. You just made mention of the fact that it's magical and it's a mystery, and you do have a poem called Magical Mystery, so maybe this is a good time to read that one. It's on 125, Pam.
Thank you. Magical Mystery. My privilege, while the world is asleep, is to witness final moments. Labored breath, its only action. A man awaiting transition from breathless to beyond. How is it that these mystery-filled moments unite with earliest beginnings, blending newborn night awakenness with death's darkened calling? A door gently opens. A new life slides through it, cradled in arms warm and loving. While upstairs or across town in ages, another life slips out into the waiting arms of eternity.
I love that.
I do too. You know, it's something I'm aware of because occasionally I do vigil sitting with the hospice program, but there's less call for it with that program. Do it much more with the hospital. And so it's nighttime and I'm walking the hall heading, you know, as we know in the hospital, it's a distance.
It is.
And I'm seeing other faces and I'm just really aware of the breadth of experiences that are going on in any given moment within that whole structure.
It's so true. Yeah.
And when I'm sitting with someone who's dying, there may be someone up in labor.
Yeah.
And someone entering the world at that same moment. Yeah. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah. Actually, why don't you read Hallowed Hallway on 39?
Oh, I think that one
talks about this very...
You're very good at knowing me,
phenomenon.
Thank you. Yes, this one really relates completely intimately to what we were just talking about. Hallowed Hallway. A name sounding vaguely familiar and a room number. But he's being transferred, I am told. What new experience awaits me in the sacred territory of dying? As I enter the hospital, moving through long, winding hallways, faces pass me, concerned loved ones easily identified, other countenances with focused expressions hurry to their next destination. Oh, hallowed hallways and rabbit-warren chambers, you bear witness to days and nights of joy and sorrow, fears of diagnosis, apprehension about treatment, families sitting vigil with dying loved ones, all intervals of uncertainty, while above, on the next floor, a joyful new life begins. This medical center, one vast vessel holding the fullness of life, balancing beginnings and endings and all the challenges of health-filled existence in the moments, days, months, and years that lie in between.
I think that's a wonderful way to look at this, just how that hospital has so much happening in so many different aspects of or parts of the cycle of life, you know.
It's amazing.
Now, you do, I think, go to people's homes sometimes or sit with them in hospice. So I'm curious if the experience is different for the patient in those three settings that you've noticed. And is it different for you in those three settings?
Volunteers do sit vigil with people that are on the hospice program, whether they're at home, in a nursing home, or in what's now the new McClure Miller VNA Respite House.
Mm.
Dying is dying.
Yeah.
And dying has many faces. And whether I'm in the hospital or someone's home, there really are common denominators because of the intention.
Sure.
The reason that I'm there. So I wouldn't say that it is very different. It's just in the hospital, I'm less likely to have contact with family.
Yes. Right.
In the home, I'm more likely to. And in the VNA Respite House, there's staff that I'm familiar with, and it's a familiar place for me because I volunteer there.
Right.
So there's that aspect of known community around the experience for me.
Sure.
But the actual dying process has common denominators, certainly, no matter what the location.
Right.
And each face represents a different experience for me.
And I wasn't going to ask you to read this one, but there is a section in the book called Ancestors, and there's a poem in there where you talk about having actually walked into a room and seeing a patient who reminded you so much of your grandmother, it took you a moment to kind of, like, process that.
Oh, it was just, I never know when I, you know, that's why
right.
I stop when I go to the door,
yeah.
because I just don't know what's going to happen when I enter. And in that particular case, this actually was a nun, and her religious sisters were there with her, and they and had been and were going to be leaving for the evening and the night, and we were going to take turns covering. And, you know, they were all such beautiful, gentle souls, mm-hmm. as was the woman lying in the bed. And I walked to the end of the bed to speak to the woman who would be leaving. And I looked up the bed, and oh my gosh, it was my grandmother's face. Mm. And I hadn't had, of course, it wasn't my grandmother. She had died many, many years before, but
sure.
My background is nursing, and I lived out of state when my grandmother died, and I was very close to her. And she was in Fanny Allen Hospital for quite a while, and because I was pregnant and due, I didn't have the opportunity to be with her.
Mm.
And she literally died the day before I came home.
Mm.
So I greatly missed that experience
mm-hmm.
Within me. And so all of a sudden when I saw this face, I mean, I was a little startled.
Sure.
And eager for the people to leave. So I could be with my grandmother. But it very quickly converted for me to an experience where I could feel like I had had that experience with her.
Right.
I just was so happy to sit beside this woman.
Right.
Very unexpected.
You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the author, Pamela Heinrich McPherson, whose 2016 poetry collection is Vigil, The Poetry of Presence. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you'd go to iTunes and rate it, review it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thank you, and keep listening.
Now, they're not always gently going into the night, and they're not always without a certain amount of hardship and pain. I'm sure a lot of them are full of hardship and pain. I was wondering if you could read Midnight Vigil, and then we can talk a little more.
Midnight Vigil. Unshaven, balding, twitching and occasionally reaching out, a light restlessness. Was he turned, I ask? The nurse. I took his pillow out. He's been here for about a year, I learn. Oh my. Dialysis discontinued 6 days ago. Each inhale ends in a gentle gurgle. The March wind howls through the trees around the buildings, a warm midnight wind that will caress my body when I leave, my grateful, able, life-engaged body. But first, sleep, my friend. Find a peaceful place. Rest bones weary from illness. Travel chemically to a place of peace. Your tough journey is almost complete. You are at the finish line. This day is moments away from being done.
Mm. Thank you very much.
I do speak to people. I do say words of affirmation mm-hmm. or encouragement.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I might say, I'm just sitting here with you. I'll be next to your bed. You're doing a great job. Mm-hmm. You're doing important work right now.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to be sitting here with you.
Yeah.
So I don't sit in silence. There's a lot of silence, but I don't sit in silence. I don't feel compelled to be silent.
Right.
You know, we believe that hearing is always available, even to the last moment of life. And that's assumed. So for me, it's very important to acknowledge and affirm and encourage.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned in that poem the tough journey, and I feel that it must be very hard to watch sometimes, that I would feel helpless, perhaps. Do you ever feel that way, or is it just part of what you've agreed to do, and your presence is what you have to offer? So,
that's a really good question, Shayla. Do I ever feel that way? Of course, there are times that I feel like I wish I could do something more,
mm-hmm.
but they're the exception. The care that's given is so attentive and good, attentive to symptoms and needs and
yes.
good. And we have an amazing palliative care team mm-hmm. at the hospital mm-hmm. through which many of the referrals come for volunteers. And they're so goal-focused.
Yeah.
They're so focused on patient goals and family intentions and loving support, giving loving support to strangers, that it's not very often that I'm in situations. There are certainly situations I wish were different. Death is premature. I wish they could have lived longer.
Right.
You know, those sorts of things. But as far as painful endings, troubled, poor symptom management, extremely rare.
Yeah.
Care is so attentive.
Yes. Now, I'm not going to ask you to read this one, but you do have another poem called Nothing Dignified, and you touch in that poem on the body's lack of dignity at the end, how there are certain functions that maybe we don't have control over anymore, and so it's not dignified at the end. And this is a little hard to read, and I wondered, now you said most of the patients are not responsive at this point, but I'm just wondering if it's ever hard for patients to be witnessed, in that state.
Those things are gone today. If from where you're sitting now, you were put in a hospital room in the state that you're in today, and suddenly are stripped of all of the things that are important to you, not because someone is doing it in a wrongful way, but because illness or sudden illness
yes.
has taken over, that might be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But in most of these situations, we're witnessing a process.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is a letting go.
Mm-hmm.
It's the body slowly slowing down, the mechanisms of the body being worn out, and the most important mechanisms that keep it going, the heart and lungs, being the main functioning part of the body in this process as people gently drift
yep.
Toward their death.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because of excellent symptom management.
Mm-hmm.
And care.
Mm-hmm.
But the superficial, how I look, those things just don't seem to be present
sure.
at that point. And I think in that poem, I open it by saying something about someone who doesn't have their teeth in.
Yes, you did. Teeth in a jar or something.
Yeah. And it's just a part of the a part of the letting go, and certainly for those of us that go into the room, we see people as they are. We see their soul,
mm-hmm.
we see their heart.
Right.
We the more superficial things are
right
are gone,
and it's not like we had that much control at the beginning either. I wanted to ask you a little bit about something. You did mention this very briefly earlier, but I know that you are very careful in publishing these poems to protect the privacy of the patients and their families.
Completely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, that's so important. We don't speak about any patients ever by names or any identifying mm-hmm. factor. And that has been so forever, certainly all the time I've been involved in number of decades. There are some poems at the end of my book that had a deep personal feeling for me, and I felt a really strong heart connection with mm-hmm. the individuals. And I tried to change the poems. I tried to change the names, make up names and whatever. And there are some poems in my book that the name is made up. But it changed the context so much for me personally that I decided to go to the families and ask them if I could ask their permission. Mm-hmm. I have their written permission to actually use the names.
Oh, okay.
So that is always, 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 always respected.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes the patients are cognizant. Do they express gratitude to you at all, or do they want to talk? I remember there was one about a man who wanted to tell his stories.
Yeah, that was a little different.
Okay.
Because that wasn't, I mean, that was within 5 days of his dying, and that's an amazing, that's one of my favorite poems. It's an amazing poem, and it's quite long, though.
Okay.
But it's called Is It Time?
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I was, this was with hospice, and I was asked to do something that I've done a number of other times by special request, and that's go in and preserve someone's story. They have stories they want to leave behind, and I've taken that task on in a number of different ways with different patients.
Sure.
And that was the case with this. But as it turned out, this man only had 5 days. So in fact, it was a little bit like sitting vigil because the time ended up being so short.
Okay, I see what that yes.
But my mission in that situation was to record and preserve his stories, which I did.
Yeah. Another wonderful service, because I'm sure that people all through their lives are thinking, I'm going to write this down. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I really should write this.
I'm one of them. I'm sure you are too in some way. It was just a wonderful experience.
Sure.
He just, he wasn't, he was alert, but had significant challenging symptoms and was drowsy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you can be alert and drowsy, but for me, he was alert.
Yeah.
And he could tell stories.
Yeah.
And he'd be sleeping when I'd come, and he'd fall asleep as soon as I left.
Oh, wow.
But his eyes would light up and twinkle when I'd say his name and say, would you like to tell me another story?
So did you write those down, or did you record him?
I recorded him.
Okay, for his family.
I recorded him. I went in every day for 4 days and recorded about an hour and a half of his stories each time.
Oh, wonderful.
And then the fifth day, we tried, but there was, as the poem says, there was to be no more.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
In one poem, Waiting, you write about seeking out a patient's obituary after he has died in order to learn about who he was. And so that was interesting to me. I wondered how often you do that. But also, does it ever strike you as a little bit strange or unfair that you cannot know these people that well until after they're gone and their obituaries are available for you?
Well, you know, when we enter a room, we volunteers who sit vigil, I know I do, and I'm sure many other people do, is we look in the room for clues.
Sure.
About who this person is.
Yeah.
I remember, and I think there's a poem about this one person, one older man that I sat with, who was so distinguished looking, you know, and I just wanted to know what his life's work was. There was no way I would know. But I sat there imagining whether he might have been a banker or a favorite science teacher.
Yeah.
Or there was just something that really drew me to him. You know, speaking for myself, I'm fully accepting of going in anonymously. They have no need to know me.
Right.
I do not need to know them. I am there to be present. There have been a few times where I could be a little more present when the patient was aware and could talk to me. You know, one patient in particular who was a Roman Catholic, and that's my own background a ways back. And I actually sat and sang to him quietly, because I'm not a singer, but I can pull up all those Dominus vobiscums and just even in Latin, some of the songs from years ago.
What was the one, Pacem? I think you've got a poem that's titled that, right?
Dona Nobis Pacem.
Dona,
yes,
right,
that's actually it. The person I think I'm referring to.
Yeah, right.
But so do I look at the obituaries? Sometimes in the hospital, people can be from anywhere in New York State. I mean, the hospital covers a very broad territory. And truthfully, for the most part, I'm present when I'm there, and when I leave, I let go.
Yeah.
And go back to my life.
Right. Well, that's very consistent with your attitude about you're there as another, let's say, another soul in the room, and not as a person with a life and a personality and a, yeah,
correct,
and a story.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, I might mention, though, and when I do, I go out and do readings for groups, and when I do the readings, I at some point love to share that what I do comes from a place of being anonymous, and I fully accept that. I actually, you know, respect and honor the anonymity. That's mm-hmm. what this is about. Mm-hmm. It's not about me in any way except me being present. But there are other ways that we sit vigil. You know, a woman, a mother sitting with her daughter while she's in labor, that is sitting vigil.
Absolutely, sure.
A friend sitting with a friend who's going into surgery in a few minutes, that's a form of sitting vigil. And those are personal. And I actually had the book together before I realized that I had spent quite a bit of time sitting vigil because our son, our middle child, when he was 30, was hit late at night by a drunk driver mm-hmm. and almost died. Mm-hmm. And we left our home in the middle of the night. He lived out of state. We were gone for almost 3 months and called our other kids in, and we just stayed with him to get him through that. And I actually wrote some poems then, too, because I kept a journal during that experience that I wrote everything in, every doctor's name, every, you know, that I needed to remember.
Are any of those in here?
They're separate. They're not in here.
Yeah.
I have them. I do have them with me. But that's a little, that's a,
another time.
That's something that just needs to be, I feel a need to acknowledge when I'm speaking.
Sure.
Because that is a different type of presence.
Yeah.
You right. know?
There's a different kind of hope around it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I sit vigil in the hospital, I'm 100% present during that time. I try to be.
Yeah.
But when I leave, my heart is not, for the most part, not heavy.
Yeah.
I've done what, I've offered what I could. I've done my task.
Yes.
I've done it the best way I could.
Wonderful.
But a little different when it's personal.
Yeah. Okay. I have a few questions that don't have to do with specific poems, and then I'm going to ask you to read one more before we finish. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the design of the book. I love the design of this book, the cover, and also the chapter artwork that is on the pages with the epigraphs. Did the designer at Red Barn Books help you with this? Did you kind of come up with the design on your own? How did that go?
No, the design is mine.
Okay.
I was talking with a friend, Carol McDonald, a dear friend, who is a print artist.
Okay.
And telling her about the project, and she said to me, "Pam, I can see the cover." And I said to her, "You can, because so can I. I want to know what you see." And she said, "I just see the word vigil." And I said, "That's exactly what I see. But I also see my meditation candle
uh-huh.
on the cover." And when I showed her a picture of it, she was like, "That's perfect."
Yeah.
So she said, you could sketch that. And I was, anyway, we'll move quickly ahead in the story. I hired her to create the cover for me.
And is it a paper lantern?
Yes.
That's around the candle.
Around a candle.
Beautiful.
Yes. And there's a story about it in the preface.
Yeah.
Because it's very tattered. It's even more tattered if you were to see it today. The paper is, just come apart. And anyway, I said to Carol, do you think we should neaten it up a little bit? And she said, "Pam, dying doesn't get neatened
yes,
up."
Yes, that's true.
No,
right.
I think we should leave it the way it is. And she was so right.
Yeah.
She was so right.
And I love the subtitle of the book is The Poetry of Presence. That's perfect.
The title is completely mine.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it just came to me one day and I knew it was right.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
As for the layout of the book, Red Barn books in Shelburne did lay it out for me, but with an amazing friend, we went through all the poems and divided them into themes, mm-hmm. came up with chapter titles. And then once that was done, I felt like I wanted something on the chapter pages. And I actually, what's on the chapter pages, the little graphics that are on there, are from my journal.
Oh, okay.
They're, I do journaling in various forms, various times, and I've taken them from my journal.
Well, it's interesting. They look almost Aboriginal or Native American.
Interesting.
Are they doodles?
That's it. They're simply doodles.
But they're beautiful doodles.
If I'm sitting listening in a workshop, listening to a presentation or something, I'm very likely doodling like that because mm-hmm. that's the way I listen.
Right.
It's not being inattentive for me.
Right.
And no, they're completely mine. They're just...
They're
just
really cool.
Just what oozes out on paper from me. I have a creative side that sometimes struggles to find its little place to be.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to know, Pam, if you've read any books lately that you would recommend to people who might be listening.
Oh, interesting. I actually have been reading some local poetry.
Oh, great.
Books. Karen McAdden is an English teacher, I think, a literature teacher in Montpelier, and a friend of my neighbor, Major Jackson, who's also an amazing poet.
And the two of them won the Vermont Book Award years in a row.
Her 1 year and then him the next year.
Exactly.
Isn't that amazing?
That's so great.
So I'm reading her most recent book. And what else am I reading? I'm reading Louise Penny.
Oh, yeah.
The Great Reckoning right now.
Is that her most recent? Are
yes,
you all
it is. And I know it's the only one I've really read,
oh,
but
okay.
I went up to her book release in Canada.
She's a hoot. She was on the show with me one time.
What an amazing.
What a lovely person.
Amazing woman.
Yeah, she's awesome. And then I also was going to ask you what you're writing now. Are you working on a memoir? It sounds like maybe you are.
No, yeah. I'm not. Actually, the book only came to be because I was going through my journals trying to figure out what I'm going to do with those. Because I'd like to take care of them while I'm living, if I can. And I was shocked to find out how much poetry was in them.
Yeah.
And in fact, my hospice journals had 85 poems in them,
which
I was stunned by. So I'm really more in a place of figuring out what I'm going to do with what I have.
Okay.
And rearranging and finding a new way to save things that are important to me for my children.
All right. Now, I have a question actually about your publisher. So Red Barn Books was part of Windridge Books, which went out of business, sadly, in June. So what happens to your books at this point?
Good question. I was debating about Red Barn Books served me so well in creating the book and helping me put it together and publishing it. But in time, they simply became a pass-through for me. I'd call them for more books. They'd call the order and the books came to me. And I was in kind of an ethical internal dilemma myself about whether I was going to stay with them, what I was going to do.
Sure, yeah.
And then I received a letter from them.
Mm.
In June,
right.
Saying that they were closing their doors. Very, very unfortunately.
Yeah.
They provided an amazing service. So I actually am self-publishing through a company online.
Okay.
A respected company. And as it turns out, it's exactly the company Red Barn was going to
okay.
for the publication aspect. In time, I figured that out.
Ingram? Is it Ingram?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it exactly the same look, the book?
The book is exact.
And
exactly
does it still say Red Barn on the back?
No.
That's the only thing.
That's removed, and it's removed from the copyright page, too, of course. Red Barn advised those who were working with them about how the copy needed to change.
Okay.
So, so I'm doing it on my own now.
Okay, great. I wonder if you could read Important Work, This Dying.
I'd love to. You know, I should say I'm looking at my own copy of the book, and this has 5 or 6 people's names written around the page because I encourage people to tell me what their favorite poems are, and then I write their name in my book.
Yeah.
And I love when I'm reading a poem to think about
who
the people
the
for
poem.
Whom it was most meaningful.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this one's for you, Roddy. And Tom and Dave. Important work this dying. Important work this dying. Lying in wait, existing. Sleep closed eyes or unresponsive stares. What goes on? Is it dreaming or oblivion? Does a mind chatter? Or does it float on the waves of immeasurable endlessness? When the time comes, will I have the courage to say, let me do this the best way I can? Let me go through my dying process in as conscious and intentional a way as possible. I want to suck the marrow out of life, to lift high the blinds on life's windows, and embrace the warmth of sunlight, absorb the beauty of the night sky. I can do it if you'll be there with me, as I also face storms and clouds. Let's be courageous together as I walk my journey to forevermore.
Mm. That's my favorite.
I'll put your name on, Shayla.
I love that.
Thank you.
I love that it tells us a little bit about how this experience has maybe changed your expectations for your own eventual journey, right?
Mm-hmm. It's been full of personal growth for me, and accepting, moving toward a full acceptance of death as just a part of the cycle of life. Yeah. Yes. It's going to be okay.
All right. Thank you. I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Vigil, The Poetry of Presence by Pamela Heinrich McPherson. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
What a pleasure. I've loved sitting with you, Shayla. Thank you so much.
That, once again, was a conversation with Pamela Heinrich McPherson. This week's Write the Book prompt comes to us from Pam McPherson, who suggests looking into the work of the Wake Up to Dying Project, an awareness and action campaign that encourages people to think and to talk about dying. Their website is wakeuptodyingproject.org. In reading about the Vermont-based organization, you may find stories that inspire you. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. As I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tell all your friends. Also, the show is going to be back on the airwaves soon. I'm joining the new radio station WBTV in Burlington as soon as they are up and running. So I'll keep you posted about when the show is going to be airing in Burlington, and at that point I'll start up the Bookworms calendar again. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. I want to say have a great week, but this week I feel more like I should say, if you're having a difficult time this week, I would suggest looking into ways that you can dedicate yourself to causes you believe in and write about it. Good luck.